Guys, welcome to Breaking Down Current Affairs of the World. This is your host Arjun Ghosh, and today we're gonna be covering the entire. We've already covered the whole Russia-Ukraine crisis pretty extensively. At least I have given at least a sequence of events, understanding of how exactly things have been building over the past, I'd say, decade, and how it has led up to this very moment where we find Russia launching an invasion against Ukraine. Also, I had spoken about some of the possible prospects of a second Cold War beginning and how exactly the new global order has been building up after these Western sanctions hit Russia. Today, however, right now we're gonna be speaking to Vedant Mishra, who has come here on the podcast multiple times, a really important contributor, and he has spoken here earlier about the Middle Eastern politics there, as well as the situations evolving between Russia and the West when it comes to Middle East. Today he'll be coming and talking to us about the Russian invasion of Ukraine, what his views are, what his idea of the entire thing is. And again, you all are free to have your own perspectives. They are the perspectives of Vedant are going to be shown. I'm going to try questioning him. I'm going to try seeing where we can lead to this conversation. And we're going to try understanding this entire crisis in a much better way with multiple perspectives and understand the whole thing as well. So listen on.
Yeah, hi.
Great to have you here. You can hear me, right?
Yeah, I can hear
Great, great. So without any further ado, I've already given my understanding of so what's your reaction to this whole Russian invasion? I mean, just your quick reaction to this first.
I mean, I would call it shocking, devastating, keeping in mind the pictures that are surfacing from Ukraine are, pretty heartbreaking, and such a conflict hasn't occurred in Europe since World War II. I mean, one independent nation state attacking another independent nation state, and it's pretty devastating and shocking too for that extent. However, I think one of the key aspects that we need to understand here is the whole, Putin's understanding of the post of the Putin's understanding of the Soviet era, and Putin's understanding of, Ukraine being a part of Russia. I think also lastly, I think one of my first reactions when I heard that, Russia is building up in the Ukraine border was that one of my first reactions was that sooner or later this will definitely turn into an invasion. And one of the reasons, it could be anything. It could be provocation of Article 51, which Putin actually did. Humanitarian intervention was something that I could not have been that I could not foresee, keeping in mind Russia's stance on humanitarian intervention. And other than that, I always knew that Putin would definitely go ahead and attack Ukraine. But Vladimir Putin actually going ahead and instructing his defense forces to attack Kyiv is something that even I could not foresee. Lastly, the recent news that came along of Ukraine filing a case in the ICJ, that was extremely, anyone could see it if they have a basic idea of the conflict. So yeah, this is my whole understanding of the conflict in general.
Right. So as per you referred to recent updates, and one of them has been that Vladimir Putin has essentially asked move to the second. I mean, honestly, I am going to just immediately sideline the fact that there can be any kind of nuclear confrontation between the U.S. and Russia. I think we both know it's impossible. But considering
Right,
the
right, right.
amount of resistance which Russia is facing in Ukraine right now, and Ukrainian civilians are obviously not giving in, they are gonna completely go ahead against Putin. So is he going to use nuclear missiles as one way of devastating Ukraine for once and for all?
I mean, in all honesty, I really, really, really don't think that's possible. Now, I could be terribly wrong. But what you need to understand is that after the end of World War II, nuclear weapons have always been used as an act of deterrence, where one party deters the other just by seeing a nuclear stockpile. Now, what you need to understand here is that, this Ukraine conflict is a Vietnamization, is Vietnamization in every aspect. I mean, what Vladimir Putin is trying to achieve, is something that is extremely utopian in nature. I mean, he wants Ukraine to be, I don't know, a part of Russia, or he wants to revive Soviet Union, as a lot of people say. Now, this whole concept is extremely utopian in nature. Even the fact lies that although Ukraine and Russia have very strong links, a lot of Russian speaking population in Ukraine identify them as Ukrainian, not as Russian. Other than that, having a nuclear confrontation, that is not I don't think it's possible as such, because Vladimir Putin would be essentially risking the entire, what should I say? I mean, he would be risking Russia's reputation, I mean, the not only the environmental consequences, but also internationally. This would just show that another international body failed. They could not do anything.
Right. So coming to one of your points about these basically people coming up and saying that Putin wants to somehow revive the Soviet Union, there's something that has to be understood here. That is basically, I mean, if you look at the entire map of exactly where the Soviet Union was back then, I mean, if Putin were to try to make the Soviet Union again, it would be a problematic thing for Russian economy. It will be problematic with Russian weapons
Absolutely,
because, I mean, you
absolutely.
have most of the Soviet countries as NATO basically right now. Most of them, Lithuania, Latvia, if I'm not wrong, right? So, do you want to create a new Soviet Union is far-fetched, and that only what Putin is trying to do in Ukraine is basically destabilize the government in Kiev to create a pro-Russian regime there, and only take over the eastern part of Ukraine, which where the Donbas region primarily, where somewhere more majority are basically supposedly favoring.
Absolutely, I do agree with this. However, what you also need to understand here is that, recently, Denmark has increased its security forces in Estonia, and also, Putin has sort of, given hints and threatened the Baltic states, by simply saying that maybe do not continue your activities with NATO. So, is this idea far-fetched, about Putin wanting to revive Soviet Union? Maybe. However, I think one of the key aspects of international relations would be that one has to be open to all the ideas, no matter how utopian or how stupid it might be. So, is it far-fetched? Absolutely. However, keeping in mind that no one could have predicted the fact that Putin would actually go ahead and attack Kiev, attack the capital, and not just take the Donbass region and be happy. No one, I am pretty sure I have read a lot of articles on this. No one could have predicted this. So, is Putin threatening them? Yes, but also, would Putin want direct confrontation with NATO? I really don't think so. So maybe not the revival of Soviet Union. However, Putin's understanding of the Ukrainian politics and his claims to Ukraine are pretty superficial and pretty enraging in nature, if one has to say.
Right. Yeah, you make a good point out there. And one more thing which actually you had mentioned earlier was about how, you know, the use of nuclear weapons in Ukraine would essentially like take away whatever Russia has in the world. The past 48, 36 hours. I mean, you have these countries already now banning European airspace to Russian flights. Russia already has been kicked out of bodies in the Council of Europe. Then Ukraine is calling for Russia's removal from the UNSC. You have literally even the International Judo Federation like expelling Putin. You have these personal sanctions on Putin, on Lavrov, on Defense Minister Shoigu. Considering all these developments, Russia is clearly losing everything already. I mean, except for its military power and its might otherwise, Russia is actually losing all of its leverage everywhere in the world. So do you think by taking these aggressive measures, is the West like basically putting Putin even closer to that very option of going for a nuclear strike, or at least taking some kind of an aggressive measure?
But you have to understand it in this way, all right? If we talk about Ukraine calling for the removal of a permanent member, let's look at it from a very technical aspect, okay? Leave out the fact that war is happening. Now, according to Article 6, if I'm not mistaken, of the UN Charter, if any of the members does not respect and uphold the rights and the fundamental principles of the UN Charter, they can be expelled. However, nowhere in the UN Charter it is even slightly mentioned that how on earth will you remove a permanent member.
Yeah,
Because
exactly, yeah.
if you talk about permanent members, their position has been fixated in the charter in itself.
Reserved,
So
exactly.
reserved, yeah, it's fixated. So them, like, let's say even Russia is removed, what happens then? What is the process? How would you do it? If Russia has to be removed, then you have to amend the charter, and if you have to amend the charter, it has to go through Russia, and Russia won't allow that. See, at the end of the day, as I mentioned earlier in your podcast too, UN is a is a body that has lost all its importance in general. No one cares that UN exists. It's just there for I don't know, for celebrity endorsements and everything. That is a harsh reality. Now, other than that, even if we take into account the sanctions, now what we also need to understand here is that, as far as I have read, is that Europe is still continuing to buy gas from Russia. It's not that Europe has stopped buying gas from Russia. Now, what the things that you mentioned is only and solely focused, on the actions taken by West. Has the whole world turned against Russia? Like, for example, the whole world had turned against Iraq, right? The whole world had turned against Iraq, and Iraq was pushed against the wall. But is the same case with Russia? Absolutely not. And this also shows a disparity between nations in general, because we have Iraq who went ahead and invaded Kuwait, and they were absolutely obliterated. They were destroyed completely with sanctions, with UNSC resolutions. But on the other hand, we have Russia. Do you think Russia would be affected at the same level that was in which Iraq was affected? Never. It's just not possible. Because Russia has a stand in the international community, be it as a permanent member, be it as the successor of USSR, be it as anything. They have a very good stand in the international community. And as you might be aware that Russia has diversified its economy. They do not depend on the dollar anymore. They depend on pounds, depend on euros, they
Gold.
depend on the yuan. So, it's is it the West? Definitely, they are imposing sanctions, they're imposing everything. But I really don't think sanctions would do anything as such. Look, as long as, Putin is not having a direct confrontation with NATO, he may very well go ahead and occupy Ukraine, or he may very well, go ahead, occupy Ukraine, hold a referendum there, and then say that most of the Ukrainians want the Ukraine to be a part of Russia, and he'll
Like,
make,
yeah, like Crimea basically where
like
he lived,
Crimea.
like exactly.
Exactly.
So
So,
yeah, so you do bring up a good point about how Russia has treated some of therefore, Western sanctions don't have much of an impact. Although what's happening is allies, I think for the first time, like they've come to this agreement where some Russian banks are being prevented from accessing financial communication network in the world. So, I mean, considering Russia already has its own communication system, and Russia and China are now formalizing somewhat of an alliance, do you think this SWIFT removal is in any way going to affect Russia more than it can affect Europe because of the gas payments and all of that?
Will the SWIFT the question should be, will the SWIFT removal affect everyday Russians, affect Russians who make a living through the West? Yes, it will definitely affect them, because adapting to the SFPS would take some time in general. Now, what you need to understand here is that for short term, as you can see, in the short term effect, the ruble is rising up. The price of ruble is going up. I think I last time I checked, it was around 85, $1 being 85 rubles. Now that is rising up. As long as there is a war going on, or there's a quote unquote special operation going on in Ukraine, there would definitely be some kind of some kind of, what should I say, loss of value in ruble. Removal of
Overthinking.
Swift. Yeah, like no removal of Russian banks from the SWIFT system. Yes, that would also affect them. But will it affect them in the long term? Never. Because what you need to understand here is that over the years, Russia has sort of made themselves immune to the actions that can be taken by the West. I think the fact that I think a few days ago there was a Lithuanian warship that was hit by a Russian missile. And NATO members had called for an Article 4 meeting. Now that is something that, such measures, yes. Now that is something I do not know what happened next. I did not check up, but that is something that is to look out for. I mean, look, if the NATO engages itself, if the NATO starts to, let's say, build up its military in in Estonia, Lithuania, and everything, and there is some kind of Russian provocation in the border. And the NATO intervenes. That word, in short, would mean World War III has broke out. There is no other term that I can use. And other than that, it would mean that the world what should I say? The world in general has failed. Now, again, this I would accept is an extremely far-fetched idea because it is just not possible that NATO would actually risk itself from confronting Russia. They have gone out to such an extent where they have said that. Yeah, no, Ukraine is not a member of NATO. We all are aware that Ukraine is not a member of NATO, but again, Ukraine is quote unquote your, you have some kind of agreements with them. You do supply with them weapons. You do supply them with weapons and everything. So what about that? But yeah, let's see. I think according to my understanding of the current conflict, I think the max that it could go is that, what happened in Crimea. And again, there would be some kind of uprising and everything, but let's see.
So you bring up the fact about the article for consultations in NATO, which took place. I mean, I don't know if you heard this, but apparently after these consultations, NATO for its first time mobilized its response force. NATO response force has been mobilized, and apparently right now this response force is for defensive purposes in most of
Right.
these ex-Soviet countries. So what do you think? Is this gonna in any way play as a deterrent to Putin? If he plans for a further expansion of Russia's empire? If has he got this?
Russian Empire, that's a good term. I mean, look, I honestly know that Putin would never ever risk himself from confront like no risk himself and risk the Russian landmass and the Russian people and the economy by confronting with NATO. They just won't do that. And look, just the fact that NATO is extremely hesitant themselves to confront Russia. I mean, describing my previous statement, I mentioned that NATO provides arms. That's not happening. Independent, members of NATO are providing arms to Ukraine. Now, that just shows that NATO as a group is extremely hesitant to work together. Now, they may very well help Ukraine with, by giving them arms, by giving them, machinery and everything, but NATO as a group, no. So yeah, maybe NATO did think that this may act as a deterrent, but I really don't think it had any kind of effect on Putin in general. Because right now Putin is continuing his offensive in is offensive in Kiev. He is planning to engage a stage two. So let's see. I mean, honestly, right now it's extremely unpredictable what may happen. It is very much possible that due to the guerrilla warfare that is being implemented by Ukraine. And the Ukrainian citizens, as far as they can, if they can sort of make Ukraine another Vietnam, then maybe Putin has the opportunity to back out and everything. But other than that, no. Like other than that, I don't think this has caused any kind of deterrent to Putin.
Right. So you basically a concept which has been inquired. And it's one thing to notice though. I mean, look at what battalions Russia has actually mobilized. If you see, those are basic we have been special forces, right? And I mean, you must know
Yeah.
you've been a quite an you've been quite interested in Syria as well. And these forces, these special operations forces that apparently been trained, have been in combat in Syria fighting ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and both, and we know terrorist organizations like these, they do use guerrilla warfare, right? That is one of their ways they survive. And considering how Russia was able to literally disintegrate ISIS after its intervention in Syria 2015,
that has gotten upper hand even here, though a guerrilla warfare.
I mean, definitely, definitely, that's extremely good point. Yeah, I mean, but also one major aspect, and that is something, this is extremely minor in general, but one major aspect is that you also need to understand here is that a lot of Russian soldiers themselves do not want to engage themselves in combat. Now, this is a very minor thing, keeping in mind they have to listen to orders, but you also like, you know, a lot of Russian soldiers see this as, like, you know, Russia, like, you know, hitting his wife or something. No, that's the concept. So, because again, Ukrainians and Russians are extremely close to each other, does Russia hold an upper hand? Only time can say. Because honestly, ISIS, if we talk about ISIS in general, ISIS, at the end of the day, it's like, you know, it's a terrorist organization, yes, but at the end of the day, the whole world is against ISIS. No one wants ISIS to exist. If you talk about regular Ukrainians who are fighting Russia, who are fighting the Russian forces, who are throwing Molotovs from their homes, is the whole world against them? No, they're in fact parading these people. They're in fact saying that these people are like, you know, patriots and they are martyrs and everything. So yes, I think this is also one of the important aspects that comes into play here. It depends. It really depends who holds an upper hand. Only time can say, honestly.
Right. Those are some really important points to bring up. I mean, the world has been in fact supporting Ukraine so far, and frankly, I mean, we both are also supporting Ukraine. I mean, seriously, the Ukrainian people, they're going through this big offensive, and I think it's important the world stands with them at this point. However, I think one important point which we brought up, which about NATO, which, you know, we both have been speaking about NATO so far, and I think when you look at one of Russia's security demands, which was brought up in January, was about not incorporating Ukraine into its own organization. Now, exactly, how do you think Russia basically views NATO in this regard?
Before I answer this question, I would also like to add another point in the previous question of ISIS. Did, like, you know, Russian intervention did help to sort of bring down, sort of help to dismantle the whole the ISIS operation. But you also need to understand that, you know, American, French, British intervention also played a major role here. Did Russia help? Yes. But also the fact that Russia committed a ton of war crimes while they were fighting ISIS, a ton of war crimes while they were fighting the rebels in Syria. So yeah. Coming to the next question. Just, you know, understand this major point of Russia's demand in general. Now, look, some of Russia's demands was sort of put forth by the Soviet Union too when it was implemented. But again, Soviet Union was dismantled and everything that happened. But I think when Russia had initially put this demand, okay, that aspect, what a lot of analysts were saying was a maximalist negotiating position, or it was a pretext for invasion. Now, it was the latter, of course. But if, let's say, Russia did apply this maximalistic negotiating position where they said that, you know, we want this and they would settle for something less, that would have been a very fantastic move in general. Now, look, this aspect of, like, you know, of them asking NATO that, listen, we please not let Ukraine join, because let's say then they continue that NATO is an imperialist force, etc., etc. Same argument. It's very old now. But again, this demand in itself is extremely absurd. Honestly, it's extremely absurd. It goes against the basic principles and fundamentals of international law, law of treaties. It goes against the sovereignty of a nation. It's extremely absurd. Like, it is as if it was saying that I enter someone's house and I start instructing them what to do. I mean, good morning. You are like, no, I am at their house. So technically, I am at their mercy. They can be hostile towards me, but I am at their mercy. They can do whatever with me, but it's not the opposite. Like, you get my point, right? So it's like this demand in general is extremely absurd. And initially, people did think it was a maximalistic negotiating position. But again, this was a good pretext for invasion too, if one can look at that. But whatever, Russia gave genocide as a reason.
I mean, you do speak about absurdity in this case. I mean, honestly speaking, I don't see an absurdity in this claim. Look at exactly what happened in 1962, for example. I mean, you speak about a person giving hospitalization to someone else, basically inviting them to the house. Even Cuba did the same thing with the Soviet Union, and the US literally was against it to a great extent. It told the Soviets to move away its weapons, move away its military. Isn't that in some way the exact same thing Russia is trying to tell the US right now? Move away your military, move
But
away your
again, the
weapons.
world,
Right.
I agree, but again, the world did say that whatever US is doing is absurd. I mean, if we read the Cuban Missile Crisis, USSR did call this a violation of international law, but other nations also came in support of USSR. This did say that whatever US is doing is absurd. US demands are absurd. Yes, from a security position, absolutely. But what you need to understand here is that what US did, they imposed a quarantine on Cuba. They did not essentially say to Cuba, listen, Cuba, you cannot do this. You just cannot do this. They imposed a quarantine, they imposed sanctions. Now, that is something, a quarantine is absurd, but sanctions, something that we can work with. If Russia goes ahead and imposes sanctions on Ukraine, saying that you are committing genocide, makes sense. But if Russia goes ahead and it asks Ukraine that, you know what, you cannot join NATO and you cannot do this, you cannot do so because we are saying so. And if you do, there will be severe consequences. This is blackmail. This is the legit definition of blackmail. And that is not how international relations, international law works. Not
Okay,
in
so
21st century. Yeah.
right. So you bring up this important point of Russia basically is holding a gun to Ukraine's head while speaking about its NATO aspirations. Primarily, I think before we go into all of this, I think it's important for me to note two things first of all. One is US foreign policy is in one way also based upon a particular structure called the Monroe Doctrine. The Monroe Doctrine primarily like basically has this thing where the US has influence in the Western Hemisphere, and that no country, be, like any hostile action in the Western Hemisphere, is against the US primarily in one way. And at the same time, you find Russia not having made these demands just in 2022. They made these demands in, they first made it when NATO first considered bringing Ukraine and Georgia into its alliance in 2008, when Russia had clearly told NATO that there are particular security concerns regarding these two countries. And NATO cannot be bringing these countries into the border. And let's also remember one more thing. When NATO's first wave of bringing countries began in 1999, Russia didn't say anything. Russia didn't say anything. But when it came to Ukraine and Georgia, like literally on its border, and to some extent quite large, right? So when it did pose a legitimate security threat, Russia did point it out, and the Deputy Foreign Minister and back then President Putin didn't find bringing up this point. So why do you think NATO did not consider those? Not to mention, I mean, after this Bucharest conference took place and the declaration was passed, I mean, Russia went ahead and provided arms to Georgian rebels. I mean, this was another signal from Putin that if you go ahead with this,
Right, right,
we'll
right.
not be at peace, and we are gonna make it impossible for you in that way. So why do you think NATO did not like listen to Russia back then?
You also need to understand one thing, right? When we talk about the Monroe Doctrine, or we talk about the disruption in the Western Hemisphere that is against the US, does US discreetly go ahead arm the rebels? Yes, but does US releases public documents stating the fact that if this XYZ country in the Caribbean or in South Americas joins, let's say, the Russian alliance, if let's say a hypothetical Russian alliance, we will go and invade. Does US does so? No. Do they discreetly do so? Yes, they do. You also need to understand the difference between South America's now and the Caribbean. It is very different from the Europe. It is very different from Europe in general, because in Europe, one of the important aspects that you need to take into fact is the Euromaidan movement, also called the Revolution of Dignity. People in Europe want to join the European Union in 99, and also in 1994. Europe gave away its nuclear stockpiles with the guarantee that Russia, UK, USA would protect the sovereignty and etc. Right. So people in Europe do want to join European Union. People in Georgia, I think I do not have much idea about Georgia in general, but people in Georgia do want to do this. People in Georgia want to become a part of NATO. Now, this in general should be an enough sign to Putin that times were changing. Putin cannot have things as he wanted. And also, if you talk about the South Americas and West America, South Americas and the Western Hemisphere, you also need to understand that human rights violations are rampant, extremely rampant there. Let's talk about Europe. Even if you talk about Europe, human rights violations are there, yes, but making up absurd claims of genocide, having differing notions of genocide, honestly won't help. It just won't help. And I think these are a few differences that one has to weigh in if they have to compare the US foreign policy to Russian foreign policy. And also understand one fact that US and Russian foreign policy are different, are extremely different here. Because if you talk about the Russian foreign policy in general, they do not believe in the interventionist agenda. Russia has always been a country that has sort of taken a very conservative stance when it comes to international law. They're not the one who will go ahead and sort of support R2P. They are not the one who will go ahead and support humanitarian intervention. Never. They are not the one who will go ahead and support, what should I say? States attacking non-state actors without having any pretext. They are not. They will not do this. Because again, Russia has sort of solidified its foreign policy over the years. So yeah, these are a few differences. And by doing this, Putin is sort of changing Russia's stance completely from A to Z.
Right. You also do, if I bring up the point of Russia's allegation and genocide in Donbass, and I mean those are pretty much, I mean they are completely false because there's no proof. I mean Amnesty International itself hasn't given any kind of organization, so it's actually very 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 apparently. So
So
that's one thing to also
even here,
consider.
I think, even here, I think the recent filing of the case. Now, I haven't seen the application yet. The recent filing of the case, and the tweet of Zelensky, where he stated the fact that Russia is sort of, differing the notions of genocide. Now, what you need to understand here is that, this is a very interesting case that would be that would like you know the world would notice, because Ukraine has made a very creative argument here. They are not sort of penalizing Russia for invading Ukraine. They are, again, I have not looked at the application. This is just my initial take on it. They're not penalizing Russia for let's say invading Ukraine. They are penalizing Russia for differing the notions of genocide. Now that would fall under Article 9 of the Genocide Convention. Both of the parties are a party to it. USSR had reservations to Article 9, but it was withdrawn in 1989. And other than that, what should I say? It's a very creative argument to make. I mean, ICC judgments won't help at all, but in the international stage, this would help. And also, there's already one case pending against Russia. So yeah, in the ICJ.
I mean, if you could, for our listeners, just like and for me also, I mean, frankly, like make us aware of what Article 9 of the Genocide Convention really is.
Yeah, sure. So Article 9 of Genocide Convention, in short, if I have to explain it to you guys, is that it's that if parties have if the parties sort of have a conflict with the interpretation of genocide, with the definition of genocide in general. So Genocide Convention in general is an extremely funny thing, because it's just a fun fact. It's just because Stalin, because when Stalin was there, he sort of altered the Genocide Convention. And he said that you can go ahead and kill your political opponents. That is not genocide at all. So yeah, Genocide Convention in general is sort of flawed in itself. However, Article 9 is something that that Ukraine is claiming is extremely creative in nature, honestly.
Right. Okay, that's a good point to make. Also, by the way, speaking about uselessness, I mean, like you already mentioned uselessness, and the UN right now apparently is going to be voting upon a resolution on the United for Peace, and basically the UNGA will be apparently taking some recommendations regarding this crisis. So what do you think? I mean, is it going to have any kind of effect, even if like a statement of world opinion? Is it going to be a statement, or is it going to be much more than that?
I think General Assembly resolutions, it depends upon the text of the it depends on the text of the resolution. They may be binding, and this was proved by the case of Namibia versus South Africa and ICJ. But again, I mean, it's pretty useless. I mean, UN any resolution passed by the UN until unless it does not fall under the Auschwitz Chapter 7, It really won't help, honestly. Like, it honestly won't help because it's also of chapter 7, and it talks about intervening in another state. It's pretty useless because even if it's binding in nature, what is the mechanism put in place for a state to implement it? And what happens if they do not implement it? What happens if they do not implement it? They will put sanctions. Cool enough. And the sanctions goes through which body? UNSC. Who is sitting in UNSC? Russia. So it's pretty useless.
I mean, yeah, analysis is important, but I mean, Russia is primarily holding the key or to every single important document it goes through for any kind of action the UN can take. I mean, the UN obviously has been rendered useless in this case as well. So I mean, so we both are obviously Indians, and obviously there's one important part in the whole world, the talk around India's policy kind of whole thing. So far, India, at least on the record, has been calling for de-escalation and has been even abstaining from any
It's
kind of
a
resolution in general.
smart thing to do, honestly.
I mean, exactly, it's because you know you have already important defense partner of Russia, and I mean at the same time you have India also increasing its ties to the West. And moreover, you know, with this India-China conflict, I mean, Russia has been in fact a mediator, quite a like a very important mediator in this whole conflict. So do you think, I mean, New Delhi is trying to basically mediate between both Russia and the West, basically to ensure that these things don't backfire on what's happening in the LEC?
I mean, actually, it's look, India's whole policy of non-alignment and like not condemning things is pretty smart because when you are a developing nation, right? When you are a developing nation, you have an incentive to keep all the parties happy rather than rather than let's
The one
say,
side is wrong
yeah,
and one side is
one side
right.
is wrong and one side is right. That is something that you can do once you are developed. India only takes that position. I have studied India's stance on a lot of issues. India only takes that position when it comes to them, when it comes to Pakistan, when it comes to Bangladesh and everything, or when it comes to them, when any acquisition is thrown upon them, they only take that position. They have never, ever, ever, in India's foreign policy, they have always steered cleared of, taking sides. They would rather act as mediators, or act as mediators and settle the conflict rather than taking sides. That is something that is extremely smart, honestly. And for the Congress leaders and the people who were calling on India to condemn the crisis, no, it's something that is just not required for now, because you would be pissing off Russia for no reason. You do not need that. So yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Russia also is like looking to expand its economic ties in Asia because of what's happening in Europe, obviously. And I mean, India could be one of its important allies in this regard. So I mean, it's obvious, it's strategic interest of New Delhi that India continue its policy non-alignment. So I mean, do you think, I mean, this Ukraine crisis so far, I mean, you have countries in the Middle East, in Africa, even in South America, where all of them are pretty much having to choose a side between Russia and the West, right? Given this time, do you see another second Cold War coming up? That this could be a second Cold War. Now, India needs to do what it did back then, a new non-aligned movement, which is taking all these Middle East and Africa and South American countries into account.
I'm sorry, I got a bit confused. So your question being that Middle Eastern and African countries have to take a stance.
Yeah, exactly. And they have to do this answer. I mean, this is what's basically happening on them. This pressure has been mounting on them. And I mean, you can understand. I mean, this Russian invasion of Ukraine is
I
essentially the
understand,
conclusion of the Second
understand,
Cold
but
War.
no, I understand that, but you have to understand the fact that when we talk about the African countries in general, most of the African countries right now sitting in the council of, for example, Ghana and everyone have said that the conflict is wrong. It's not justified. Russia is doing wrong. I haven't read the statements, but I did go through the synopsis. But again, you have to understand the fact that most of the African nations fall under the African Union. African Union would advocate for peace. Most of the African nations have been advocating for peace and everything for a very long time. So suddenly, if they change their stance and they say that, no, I don't. I think that they should mediate and they should de-escalate, that would sound wrong, because it wouldn't sound wrong, but it would be hypocritical of them. Because then again, for a nation who has been advocating for peace, who has peace should be maintained above all, who has always condemned any kind of nation which has act aggressively, then it would be hypocritical of them if they suddenly took a very non-line
Yeah,
stance.
that's also a very
Yeah.
valid point to make. It's also a very valid point to make. And I think one more thing, which basically I think I should bring up about, I mean, we suppose sanctions are right, and how they could like impact Russia and the West in some way. I mean, obviously now people are looking at the US right now, how the Biden administration has done so far in its foreign policy objectives, and we all know about the debacle in Afghanistan. Do you think the Biden administration has done anything? Like, I mean, has it like, so say, fulfilled America's foreign policy objectives when it comes to Ukraine? I mean, at least how they responded so far. How would you judge it?
US fulfillment of the foreign policy in Ukraine, no, they have failed miserably. Like, they have failed extremely miserably because they aren't being able to do anything in general. I mean, what is US doing right now? They are putting sanctions. I mean, I think one of my friends had summed up the whole aspect of sanctions very well. That is, sanctions are olive branches, sorry, yeah, sanctions are olive branches given to Russia, which are hidden in thorns. So that's true. Sanctions wouldn't hurt the US, it wouldn't hurt the the Russian economy at all. Other than that, US has gone ahead and announced that these sanctions aren't applicable to the gas, to the buying of gas and etc. So no, the sanctions won't hurt at all. And also, US fulfillment of policy? No. Ukraine is neither a part of NATO, neither Ukraine is neither a part of NATO. Ukraine has been invaded by Russia. That was one of the worst fears of USA. It has been invaded by Russia. USA cannot have the option of full confrontation with Russia. So it's a mess. It's a mess, honestly. They have failed their foreign policy objective if we have to look at it.
Right. Again, speaking about foreign policy objectives as well, I mean, so far, I mean, how would you, I mean, look, we both also are manas in one way, right? And we, how countries should, how delegates should, abide by foreign policy, etc., committee, and all that. I mean, so far, at least coming to two countries which have had like these close ties with Russia, like China and Germany. How would you like take this on in 2 points? How would you rate these two countries and their foreign policy so far? Like how they maintain the rhetoric when it comes to the Russian invasion of Ukraine?
Germany has to play extremely smart, and they have to, not completely go with Russia, but they have to maintain their Nord pipeline and so play extremely smart. China forming an alliance with Russia is something that anyone could foresee, and it was there in the form of military presence and everything. But China has al but China also has to play safe and maintain their policy of non-intervention. They have to do it, otherwise they are in big soup. And if I have to sort of explain this in detail, if we talk about Germany in general, Germany is one of the major players when it comes to European Union. It's not something new. And also, in order for the European Union to come to consensus, Germany has to cast their votes. Now, if we take this into consideration, we also need to understand the fact that European Union and all the countries in the European Union are extremely pissed with Russia, but they are not but they cannot do anything here because one will not hurt their business. Gas is a major market in Europe. So even if Europeans die in Eastern Europe, I don't think West Europe would Or the or, I don't think European Union in general or in Germany in general, because a lot of people equate Germany with European Union, would go ahead and act go ahead and do something that would hurt Russia extremely. Although they cannot do something, but they wouldn't. They really wouldn't. So yeah.
I mean, although I mean, Germany has in fact decided to arm Ukraine much more than earlier. They've obviously condemned this Russian invasion, and they've
Yeah,
also,
but
I
it's
mean,
extremely late,
Germany
don't you
did.
think?
Yeah, I mean, that's there, but
Yeah.
Germany's also closed down Nord Stream 2 pipeline. I mean, doesn't this signify a certain amount of like a major change to compared to what Angela Merkel was doing earlier, and now Olaf Scholz coming in and done.
I mean, look, even if like, okay, even if let's say they have closed down the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, I'm pretty sure within 15 days, within a month, after the situation calms down, there's a good chance they will open down the pipeline. I mean, look, as I said earlier, right, Germany has to play safe, and they cannot they cannot make it extremely obvious that we are, let's say, not taking drastic actions because we want gas to be there. And I think Olaf had also made it extremely clear is that the Nord Stream pipeline is something that does not come under the initiative of the German government, but I think it's a public and private initiative, if I'm not mistaken. Correct me if I'm wrong. So, when that comes into play, then it's just, let's say, show of, what should I say? Yeah, show
Solidarity to
of
you or some action.
solidarity. Yeah, that's correct word. So yeah, and also, the Nord Stream pipeline is a public and private initiative, right? If I'm not wrong.
Yeah, I think some. I think Gazprom is also involved. Gazprom is, I think, private. If I'm not wrong, I
Yeah,
may be wrong here, but
right.
still.
So yeah, it's a show of solidarity. It's a show of solidarity. It would just be there for 15 days. It won't. I'm pretty sure if I did mention Nord Stream pipeline being open, then I'm extremely sorry, but I'm pretty sure it's a show of solidarity. I wasn't aware of the information, honestly.
All right, great to have you here, Vedant. I mean, it's been great talking to you. A great amount of understanding of everything in hand. And I
Right,
hope we
right.
covered everything. Thank you so much for being here. All right, and I look forward to having you
Yeah.
here very soon again.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Bye. Guys, thank you very much for listening to the entire podcast episode. Here we try to again cover up some of the important points I brought up earlier in my own episode as well. I think what's important to understand here in the Russian invasion of Ukraine has been that there are a number of foreign policy changes. There's somewhat of a second Cold War coming up, and there are countries which are calling for some which are calling for further condemnation of Russia, some which are mediating and some which are like outright siding with Russia in this whole thing. You have the UN having proved to be another useless body. I mean, as always again. I mean, and yeah. I mean, these formerly geopolitics again are playing out. I mean, we have to obviously see how Russia takes over Kiev. That hasn't happened yet. We don't know exactly why Putin went ahead with the notification regarding the nuclear missiles, the second stage of it. But there's obviously huge concern among the international community right now because, I mean, look, I don't really see any possibility of Russia and the US going into a full nuclear war. Doesn't make any sense. But we still don't know exactly why it's been done. And right now, obviously, it stands to see exactly how Russia goes ahead with this whole full-scale invasion. Do they occupy Ukraine? Do they go for Eastern Ukraine only? It's very difficult to say at this particular point of time. Ukrainian forces continue to go with more rebellion. They are obviously not backing down at all. They're more united than ever. And the Ukrainian government is fighting back by all means. Even Anonymous also has been involved in hackings against Russia, which shows that multiple cyber wars have begun. So this is quite some important development taking place in this conflict. We'll obviously cover this probably much, much more. I mean, I can't obviously speak on this before 16th. I mean, got my damn exams. But I mean, I'll be speaking on this quite soon after that. So yeah, guys, keep on listening to the podcast. Keep on sharing my episodes. Make people aware about these geopolitical issues. These actually will impact the world and impact you all in multiple ways. I mean, oil prices are going beyond $100 per barrel, and gas prices are also skyrocketing in Europe. So it's actually very, very concerning for even an average European citizen or even an average citizen in the world who has something to do with oil and gas. So there you go, guys. Thank you very much for listening to the podcast. Share with everyone, the friends, family, anyone who's interested in foreign affairs. And rate the podcast on Spotify. Keep on giving us reviews. Get in touch with us. We've got our email, hforeignpolicy101@gmail.com. If you even have an Instagram ID, that is @breakingdowncurrentaffairs, all small letters. And on Twitter, we are at breakingdowncu1, BA capital. Go ahead, follow us. We'll be giving some live updates about whatever is going on. We're trying to keep in touch with all you guys, like trying to ensure we understand our audience well. I'm also going to be putting up some questions on Spotify, so you guys can ask questions. We'll try to answer. And I mean, the email is always open, so if you have any doubts, anything you want to ask us, any new episode you want us to make, I mean, we're always here. And after 16th, you will see me again. Thank you very much. Or maybe you'll hear me again. Okay.
All right, thank you very much.